You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hi, everyone. We're here in Advent 3, and the readings we're going to discuss today are Isaiah 61, 1-4 and 8-11. The gospel reading is John 1, 6-8 and 19-28. And the alternative to the psalm, which we're going to focus on a little bit this week and much more next week, is Luke 1, 46-55, or the Magnificat.
We sat down with Dr. Angela Sawyer again to talk all things Isaiah this week, looking specifically at the passage chapter 61. Welcome back to By the Well, Angela Sawyer.
Great to be here with you.
It's great. We'll be hearing from Angela today a bit more about Isaiah.
So we're in Isaiah 61, which the lectionary is broken up into verses 1-4 and 8-11, but we might just discuss 1-11, see how we go. We're in the last part of Isaiah here, Angela, often referred to as Trito Isaiah or Third Isaiah. What's our context here?
So generally it's thought to be a post-exilic text. So we've talked about, and when we looked at Isaiah 40, that this was a community possibly on the verge of return, whether they're in the land or out of the land is not clear. Whereas mm-hmm. when we get to Trito Isaiah, which is 56-66, it seems to be that we're dealing with a community that has returned to the land and that return is not as glorious as they had possibly hoped or been promised. And there's a lot of conflict in the land. In terms of the literary context as well, if you're reading Isaiah 40-55, it seems far more linear. We're reading a story, similar kind of forms of writing, but we get to Isaiah 56-66, and many scholars think that it forms a chiasm, so like a cross form, where this middle chapter here of 61 is actually the peak of the book. Ooh. And so it seems to go far more in a circular sense. If you're just reading it straight through and you get to the end of Isaiah, we end up with dead bodies on the street, not a text of hope.
No.
Whereas if you finish with 61 as the peak of the story and chapters 60 and 62 surrounding it, and then as we go out, the other chapters parallel each other, well, this peak is this great news of deliverance that we have.
Wow, I didn't know that about the structure here.
No, neither did I. So what does that mean about how we talk about hope? The risk of leaping to a very big question first.
Yes.
There is none.
So that this message of hope, we need to understand, was probably to a community in great division and that the hope is pushing them forward to see that. As we'll get into the verses, but they're still in ruins.
They
can see the ruins around them. When it talks about the ancient ruins of the city, this is a push for rebuilding. And the possibility that this is laid dormant, this is laid empty as a sign to us of our destruction, but actually we can move forward. But there's a lot of things you're going to have to deal with to do that.
Well, let's get into the text, which again is familiar to many Christians because Luke records Jesus reading this text in the synagogue in Luke 4.
Yes.
But here we start with, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord," or Yahweh, "has anointed me." Who's the me here?
Well, that's the great question with a lot of these passages. And one of the challenges, first of all, with Trito Isaiah or 56-66, and I say Trito Isaiah with the recognition that it's commonly read as a unity, the whole book together in its canonical form. We don't have a separate book here.
But or a third guy who wandered around the world known as Isaiah 3 or something.
Exactly, exactly. But typically this passage is seen for a couple of reasons to be linked to the servant passages that we find in Isaiah 40-55. Mm. So in chapter 42, verse 1, we have a servant being given the Spirit as authority again. Mm. So to read it in 61, it seems to be associated with the servant who we don't know the identity of, but they have been taken as messianic passages. And thus in the New Testament, reinterpreted to be about Jesus. And that is possibly why it is also a very popular passage to read at this time of year.
Mm. It's not Israel?
So usually Israel is designated as such, and it might be that it's a plural, whereas here this seems to be an individual.
Oh, okay, I see, yeah.
But we do have that move towards talking about Zion and providing for Zion, and that's obviously for a corporate people.
Mm. Yeah. So we have this figure, this servant, for want, or an anointed one, we could call him. You know, one in a sense, anointing is what was done to kings and other leaders, someone sort of set apart, anointed with the Spirit of God and maybe with oil or something too. What would you want to highlight in this text, Ange, in terms of the kind of core message and what we should be attentive to?
This text is so powerful. I think just reading it straight through, being sent to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners. Now, the first question in terms of its context is, why are these people still in this state?
Mm.
They've returned from exile. Mm. Surely this is over. We go into this second verse, proclaiming the year of the Lord's favour and the day of vengeance of our God, and there's a couple of really interesting parts to that. This seems to be linked to the idea of the year of Jubilee that we get in Leviticus.
I was going to ask and whether this, it was that. Yes.
Yeah, this eschatological kind of image, though, that it's beyond the land as such. It's beyond the return to the land. It's a much bigger vision of Jubilee. We also have this contrast that the favour is a year compared to the vengeance of a day.
Mm.
We also have a return to this comfort message in verse 2. And the other interesting part of this is that the day of vengeance section is not included in Jesus' reading of this passage in the New Testament.
Yes, and so we have this omitted that, or Jesus or Luke, whoever. Yeah, Luke. Luke.
it seems to stop at that sense of, this is the year of the Lord's favour. Here we are. You know, it's arrived. And that was received fairly well at the time in the initial reading that Jesus gives of this. Mm-hmm. As he goes on and makes some links that possibly connect to other parts of the passage that deal with foreigners and foreigners being included in this new community, it becomes far more controversial. It becomes far more radical. And I think, and Jesus is nearly thrown off a cliff at that point in the Luke account. I think the challenge for this is, we read this, you know, this lovely message of bringing good news to the oppressed and binding up the brokenhearted, and you think, what can be wrong with that? That's beautiful.
Mm.
But to do that, to bring freedom, there must be oppressors. There must be those who are holding the power, who are holding the prisoners, who have the cords of power. And for those to be released, they're not going to be happy. And I think that this is often the case with these messages of justice that we get in Isaiah, that we think are so beautiful in this wonderful eschatological future, peaceable kingdom. But often messages of peace that are brought bring a lot of anger from those who hold either the money or the power or the sense of control in the society. So this is not necessarily a peaceful message. And as we're in the Advent season, you know, as we talk about Jesus' birth, it disrupted the powers. It brought a threat. This peaceable king brought a threat to the political power. And I think that's one thing we can get out of this passage.
Yeah, and I mean, I know we're leaping ahead into sort of preaching themes and interpretation, but as you were speaking, Ange, it just strikes me how political this is, and that we have often, we're all white women sitting here, churches that are well-meaning and want to, you know, be inclusive, and thinking things like the Black Lives Matter movement. We say, yes, racism is bad, but we don't necessarily want to do the systemic and institutional things that would dismantle it, because that actually is a huge disruption to power and to structure. And, you know, so you've imbued this with a sense of the seriousness with which that we need to hear these words, I think.
It's a risk. It's a risk to get risky, involved in peace.
Which, of course, sets the whole proclaiming good news thing as a risk. It's not just a lovely sentimental good news. It's
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm struck too, and this is reflecting on your work in on trauma, Angela, that there's been great hope here, but things haven't come to pass as they'd hoped as gloriously.
Yeah.
Recovery has not come as fast as it's been yearned for and hoped for. Yeah, I'm struck by that, this passage speaking into that.
Yeah, I'm often really challenged when I'm reading Isaiah about often what we have is two layers. So these passages of hope that on the surface speak a lot of positivity and hope, that as we scratch, as we look deeper, we're seeing communities of pain. That this is why there's a need for these words. It's like a balm to a wound. When we're in places of comfort, a word of comfort can seem very frivolous, like a Hallmark card.
Mm.
When we're really suffering, it's like water in the desert to hear hope, to hear possibility, to hear a future. So for these people in this text, and for then again, the people that Jesus spoke to, we're talking about people still under imperial oppression.
Yeah.
So despite the rebuilding, the same for Jesus' community, they're under Roman rule in that time, that there's got to be a bigger hope that this injustice would not continue.
And I'm leaping really ahead here, all backwards, but that the cross is the centre of the faith really also obviously takes super seriously the suffering that is gone through before the promise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is and the promised. Cost of challenging oppression and all this, things. Mm. I wonder in the text, the lectionary does leap to verse 8 and feel free to tell us something about what it's missed out, Ange, but, you know, it goes on to talk about the Lord loving justice and hating robbery and wrongdoing. Is this a sense that there is still, is this an acknowledgement, I guess, of bad behaviour, of traumatized people acting out? How do you sort of read what's going on in these last few verses?
I think it does represent possibly what's going on in the historical community that we're seeing still this, and we know this from the post-exilic era, particularly the early post-exilic era. It was quite anarchic. So there was disruption and there was lack of basic safety. So this was very real. I think the other part of that verse that stands out to me as well is, I will make an everlasting covenant with them, the Berit Olam. Mm. This idea of this covenantal language coming back in. Again, you have hope. This covenant is not over, and this covenant is going to be everlasting. I think that's really powerful in here.
Yeah, because there's been lots of biblical covenants with Moses, with Abraham, Noah. But, as soon as we get this everlasting language, we're in a, you know.
And it's universal language too, and all the nations are mentioned among the people. I mean, we know that there was conflict there. But
and I think when we're dealing with the post-exilic community, exile meant end of covenant. It meant broken covenant. It's over. So this is actually recasting that story for them, reframing it into something everlasting, and that it would be the Lord who brought this everlasting covenant. It doesn't mean that they're off the hook with behaviour. It doesn't mean that they're not responsible in how they treat their community and one another. That's what got them into the place in the first place, was the injustice. And that's the story of Isaiah 1 to 39. And the other 8th century prophets, before we get to this time, way before.
I was struck too in verse 11, where our lectionary reading ends with these springtime garden images, which are probably easier to relate to in a southern hemisphere context right now. And there is a sense that we are coming out of a severe lockdown with COVID, and there are some signs of hope.
I'm
very conscious for some of our listeners in other parts of the world, it's actually the opposite. They're heading into winter, and in fact the COVID numbers and the the grief and worry that is causing is extreme in the other at the other end of the spectrum. I don't know if you want to say anything about that. I was just so struck by these springtime, which of course are all through the Bible as an image of hope, and that God will cause righteousness and praise to spring up again before the nations. We're returning here to the sense of Israel being God's chosen people, but not for their own sake, but the light to the nations kind of stuff.
Yeah, and we get this going back and forth in Trito Isaiah between this exclusivism and then this inclusivism. So here we have one of the inclusivism passages that all the nations being brought in. But I agree, this is also the creation imagery of the garden, and this is in contrast to what we were reading about the frailty of humans in chapter 40 being compared to grass and withering and dying. Well, here we have actually the garden is springing up, and the passage before it, we seem to have a garden wedding. So this imagery of a bridegroom, and this really stems from a number of places in the prophets, particularly from here, from Isaiah 54, where the people are imaged as a bride that's being restored to the husband Yahweh. There's some problematic features of that imagery and how it's being used, but it is also picked up in the New Testament as well, with the church representing the bride and Christ as the groom. And so this kind of imagery of salvation, addressing salvation, it's external. It's the what is happening to you internally is evidenced on the outside. And this passage really does bring up all the key words that we see in Isaiah: justice, righteousness, salvation, and praise right at the end. So if we do think about this ending, the kind of chiasm or peaking, we end in praise in this passage.
I don't think the Gospel of John goes into what John the Baptist was wearing, as Mark did last week, but I'm struck in that the contrast of the garments of salvation and righteousness and what it is that John was wearing.
The precursor or the prophets.
Yeah. The contrast with it.
And, I mean, we're in eschatological imagery here, right? I mean, this is, you know, poetic.
It's pushing way forward.
Yes, yeah. Imagining a glorious sort of end. But preaching themes, what would you?
Well, that is
a couple. But
the glorious end is the focus of Advent.
Well, that's true. Advent. So, yeah, we saw that in Advent 1 with the Mark 13 apocalyptic reading, which takes us right to the return of Christ in glory and power. So,
I mean, this is a massive theme. But what are we waiting for? I mean, yes, the answer is Jesus. But no, what are we waiting? You know, I think framing that for the context and why. You know, I think that's a question that our culture doesn't really ask. Why?
And I think it's pushing us towards this soaring idea as well of justice, that this holistic justice was possible, that the justice that they needed to seek and we need to seek is not found in empires. It's not found in the structures around that we think are going to bring it ultimately. And that's the eschatological, the ultimate justice being God. I think that can be cold comfort, though, for people in their daily suffering as well. So I think the challenge here is balancing out these messages of hope for future and present, that actually in this passage it's the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me and sent me to bring good news to the oppressed. It's a now thing as well. So it's this challenge that this was now for that community then. This was now for the community of Jesus. When he spoke this message, unrolled the scroll and basically says, this is filled up in your presence. Like basically we read it as fulfilled, but it's, well, the prophecy's been here all this time. It's filled up. It's filled up and it continues to fill up. I think that's the challenge for us, is there's some very concrete issues that are labelled here: mourning, brokenheartedness, the ruins. They're very real.
Yeah, and I really like that sense that we keep connecting our congregations back to see themselves in that long lineage that you've just, you know, that this was the good news and proclaimed in Isaiah's time, whenever, post-exilic time, in Jesus' time, and no less true and, in a sense, both urgent as well as also having this future dimension when we proclaim them today.
Yeah, I think that the challenge, though, and I'm going to throw a bit of a spanner in here, is that a lot of the people we do preach to are very comfortable.
Yes.
And what does this – we're not going to get to that here now because we're running out of time, but I think it's very interesting to look at something like this. How do you preach it to a people whose biggest worry is, I don't know, whether they can get to their beach house or not?
Yes.
Wow. That's a big challenge.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I mean, when we don't naturally in a lot of our middle-class churches associate ourselves as oppressed or captives or prisoners, maybe brokenhearted.
Well, the point of preaching is to perhaps hear where you didn't realise you were oppressed and belaboured and need conversion, so to speak. So, yeah, that is one. But it's a real question that I'm posing in terms of the suffering I know is not anything like what is depicted
no,
here.
No, and I suspect one would preach a very different sermon if this was to a traumatised, grieving, maybe refugee-type community as opposed to a white upper middle class in a city congregation, you know.
Where COVID's under control largely. Yeah.
It's got to be also about exposure to that story of the other, that this is what it is. This passage is doing is it's exposing another reality, perhaps. And as I was reading this passage again, it really did make me. It reminded me of a couple of kind of the best definitions around poverty that I've heard have been. You know, I've written down here Terry Pratchett's explanation about how hard it is to be poor, and he uses this image of boots, that if this character had had enough to buy the good boots, they wouldn't have to keep going and buying the other boots, they would be able to afford the ones that lasted. And can I read it just to end?
Please do.
This is from, I think, one of the best books I've ever read about the nature of poverty in Australia is by Rick Morton, an Australian journalist. He wrote a book called 100 Years of Dirt. And this is his explanation of life in poverty. He says, class is access to resources, to culture, to the conversation that people are having about you. For the longest time as a child, I had no idea the conversation about us and people like us was even out there. My ignorance was built on generations of accumulated concerns, survival, rent, food, repeat, no time to make the world big, no one to make it big for you. It takes more time to be poor. And I found that a very powerful reading to consider while I'm reading this passage about the Spirit of the Lord is on me to preach good news to the poor.
Thank you. That's a beautiful note to end on. And we appreciate you being with us these last 2 weeks, Angela Sawyer.
Yes, thanks you so much, Angela.
Thanks for having me.
If you're enjoying By the Well, please take a moment to review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, Robin, the Gospel reading, John chapter 1, verses 6 to 8, and then 19 onwards, I believe. Where would you like to take us with this one?
So, a few things to say about this quickly. Many of you might have already preached on John the Baptist last week and be thinking, why do we have him again? And it's a great question. But John's gospel has a very different focus. So he does record John baptizing, but he doesn't call him the baptizer in quite the same way. There's less emphasis on that. And he doesn't have him baptize Jesus. The real focus in John, in John's gospel, there's too many Johns here, is on John the Baptist, as we know him, being a witness. So in verse 7, it talks about he, John, came as a witness to the light. Mm. So in Greek, it's the same Greek word, this testimony word. Mm. So he came as a testifier, to testify to the light, if you like, so that all may believe. So again, in John, we're seeing themes that are important to this gospel, light. Mm. And of course, we know that famous bit that precedes this about the word being the light that shines in the darkness. John is very clear that we know both in verse 8 and at the end of this passage that John himself is not the Messiah. So he has a whole interrogation scene where the priests and Levites from Jerusalem actually ask him, who are you?
Mm.
And he denies being a whole bunch of things. And they, like us, might think, well, what are you doing? Why are you out here baptizing? Mm. And John includes the same quote of Isaiah 40 that we saw in Mark last week, I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. So there's a sense that John here is a preparer in the same way, but he's primarily a witness to the light, and he will go around proclaiming and preaching and testifying. So for me, if you're going to preach on the John reading this week, the theme is really witness and testimony, and perhaps to put to our communities in, you know, or to highlight in your community, it could be a chance to do some affirming, What are we witnessing to as a community? Who do we witness to?
How are we testifying? I think that'd be a really good theme. And I'm also taken just by the series of questions where they're trying to work out who he is.
Mm.
And this is tapping into what I think I probably talked about last week around the whole nature of Advent and how we talk about it and what's it for and who are we waiting for. And, you know, this the gospel is actually engaging in the questions very starkly here. Let's join them. Let's join the gospel in asking these stark questions and not making all these assumptions that everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah.
In the community and outside.
Great idea. So that's a brief look at John. But Fran, over to you. If people were to take the option this week to sort of maybe start getting into Luke with the Magnificat instead of a psalm, what would you suggest they highlight?
Well, I must admit, last time I celebrated Advent in a parish, I think I did John the Baptist in week two and then Mary in week three. So, and people might be doing that. But as you say, we'll be going into more depth in this passage in next week. So I read something quite interesting about Vivaldi, and stick with me, it's relevant, about Vivaldi this week. So Vivaldi was born in 1678 and much of his life was spent in Venice, and he worked in an orphanage, Pietà, I think it was called, and he was the choir master there. And he deliberately wrote wrote music for Mary's Magnificat for female voices because he wanted to have a girls' choir, which was quite a radical thing then because most music was written for men and boys. He knew that the boys in the orphanage got apprenticeships and got a way out and was very aware the girls didn't. And so there's something really profound. So these girls would sing the Magnificat, and in particular to create joy for their community, but also to raise so that people would donate to the orphanage, which would enable the liberation of the girls themselves. So there's something really profound, and I'll put a link to the article. It was in the Christian Century in the notes. There's something really profound there about the girls are doing what Mary's doing here through their own agency, not through their lack or their scarcity, but through their skill. They needed to be trained by Vivaldi and various others probably. But they responded to the joy and the liberation in that music and in God. Towards their own liberation.
Yeah. So that's quite beautiful and poignant when you think of orphanage girls, because Mary herself historically could have been quite young. I mean, she could have been 13 or 14.
And quite vulnerable. So that's just a little something I read. We'll put a link in, and I'm sure you could work with that in the sermon. But also just to remember that singing, this is a week of joy. There's so much joy here. Do we talk about, I mean, there's not been a lot of joy this year, let's be honest.
No.
But what are we thankful for? Perhaps lies behind this. But that singing as a response of rejoicing and joy in Scripture is quite common. We've got Miriam who sang.
Hannah
who sang, although Hannah's song is different from Mary's and using quite militaristic language. And Deborah sang as well in Judges. I think that's an interesting thing to think about. And then the obvious point, we're not actually singing in our communities at the moment. And what is that doing for our sense of joy? And how do we express musically our joy in a different way? All those things could complicate
it, but yeah. And it strikes me, given our conversation with Ange about Isaiah, that so many of the themes we talked about there in terms of justice and liberation are, of course, themes in the Magnificat. So it's a joyful recollection or assertion, prophetic protest, whatever praise, whatever language you want to use, of what God has done and is continuing to do. So to capture that joy in our own communities, what God is continuing to do.
And the miraculous aspect, which is in that passage too, about the much older woman and the younger one, the miracle of the new creation that only God can bring forth.
Well, that's a romp through the Advent 3 readings.
Yes. Thank you for listening.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.